From Hanover, New Hampshire, I'm Lee Coffin, Dartmouth's Vice President and Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid, and this is Admissions Beat. Last week, we kicked off season 8 with a back-to-school conversation that helps seniors pivot from discovery to applying as they move from junior year to being rising seniors to being seniors in high school with application deadlines coming closer and closer by the day. This week, we're going to add another layer to that pivot from discovery to applying. As we ponder the flurry of headlines and the questions those headlines are generating as this admission cycle starts to roll forward. And I would say, as a dean, that the admission beat with a little A and a little B is pretty active right now. Almost every day, there seems to be a story covering the work we do in college admissions. And I keep wondering, do these headlines help students and their parents make sense of what's going on, or does it generate more worry? And I fear worry is probably more true than help. So this week, my recurring co-host, Jack Steinberg of New York Times fame, rejoins Admission Beat to help me think about the headlines through that journalist's eye. And we'll be joined by Matt DeGrief, a longtime college counselor in suburban Boston, and as close to an expert on admission trends and policy as I know. So when we come back, we'll say hi to Jack and Matt. Hello, Jack and Matt.
Hello, Lee and Matt.
Hello, Lee and Jack.
Jack, it's nice to see you.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Listeners, you might have caught a big story by Jack in the New York Times recently, where he did a story about Dan Rather, former anchor of the CBS Evening News, now living in Austin, Texas. And Jack kind of got back in his journalist swing for a conversation with one of the titans of broadcast journalism. How was that, Jack?
It was fascinating for listeners who are under the age of 35. Dan Rather was the anchor of the CBS Evening News for more than 20 years, one of three people who did that job and sort of brought the news of the day to the nation. And he's somebody I wrote about when I was a journalist at the New York Times many years ago. He is now 93, and he is still chasing the news, writing 3 times a week for a newsletter. So it was an honor to tell that story.
Yeah. Matt, I called Jack one of the founding fathers of the admission beat nationally. You know, his work at the New York Times in the late 90s, early 2000s, when he wrote The Gatekeepers and he edited The Choice. And he was one of those first journalists that put our work in the national spotlight. And I know you and I follow that pretty closely, but you are also a big consumer of all things admission newsy. To listeners, Matt is the Dean of College Counseling and Student Enrichment at Middlesex School in Concord, Massachusetts, and he's been in that role for 24 years. So
Unbelievable, 24
unbelievable.
years.
Yeah. That really is a long gig in one school in this college counseling perch. So you've seen a lot.
I've lived through a lot. I've seen a lot. And, just moving from Cambridge to Concord, I feel like I've been blessed to, live in such beautiful spaces and work with such incredible people. And Concord is a hard place to leave. I've raised my family here, 4 kids, and it's been a real tremendous opportunity professionally.
Yeah. And listeners, he mentioned Cambridge. That's because Matt was an admission and financial aid officer at Harvard College for 13 years before he switched to the other side of the desk, as my admission colleagues often say, and went from being an admission officer to a college counselor. And I think you've thrived in both roles, Matt. But I wanted you to come on to this particular newsy pod because you and I were having a chat about the things that are keeping you up at night as the new school year starts. And I thought, you're a good foil for Jack to bring to bring the headlines home. So, Jack, I'm going to pass the mic to you as host for this episode, and Matt and I will play roles of college counselor and dean of admission, helping our families make sense of the headlines. And I hope, listeners, this is a bit more reassuring than alarming as you hear Matt and I think about what's in the news and how do you keep your wits about you as the college admission process plays out among that noisy landscape. So, Jack, it's all yours.
It's a pleasure, and thank you both. So let's imagine our audience of high school seniors and their parents and the other adults in their lives. And let's imagine an audience of your peers, high school counselors and admissions officers. Let's imagine how the developments of the last few months, especially as emanating from Washington, D.C., feel from where they're sitting. We're going to walk through a handful of those developments in a moment. But before we do, in the spirit of your charge to us, Lee, at the 30,000 foot level, can you both provide some reassuring perspective on this fall's application process?
Yes, because I always start from a position of optimism, and I'm humbled to add my own arithmetic to Matt's 24 years. This is my 31st year as a dean of admission, my 10th at Dartmouth, and I share that right now because the more things change, the more they stay the same, as the old saying goes. And as the first year class arrived, as the leaves are turning here in New Hampshire, as my admission colleagues head out around the world to meet the high school class of 26 in their schools, there's a lot of parts of this that they're feeling really normal today, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And I think for students and parents who are getting ready to actually apply, the reassuring thought is the Common App, the Coalition App, the QuestBridge App, the Institutional App, those applications are still as they were a year ago, 2 years ago. You have an opportunity to tell your story. Your transcript will share your performance in your high school. We will read your file when it's time to read files, and we will shape a community campus by campus that sniffs out the merit in that file and shapes a class to the best of our ability from that big pool of talent. That hasn't changed. And I think some of the questions you're sure to ask us may poke around some of the policies that orbit around the process that I lead and have led for 3 decades. But those fundamentals are still fundamental.
And so, Matt, if you were to read the news and just pay attention to the headlines, what Lee said might not register with how it feels inside, literally how it feels to be a student or a parent or a counselor or an admissions officer. You're sitting in the office of a high school. Do Lee's words of reassurance ring true to you as a counselor? And is that good advice to parents and students right now?
Many of the things that Lee said about the beginning of the school year and the beginning of the cycle, we're seeing that at Middlesex. We have, 100 colleges coming to visit us. I have emails from lots of colleges who want to engage with us. Our kids are excited to apply to college and engage with them. And then they have issues around, I want to tell my authentic voice in the common application, but AI clouds that conversation. How do I know the colleges actually believe it's my writing? You have concerns about testing, and testing's gotten a bit messy this fall. And those little things create anxieties. I think there's a lot of questions around financial aid, and we can talk more about this, but where is financial aid going to be in the spring versus the fall as budgets evolve? And I think there are a lot of things that families, a lot of them are first-time customers, so they don't know what's coming. And I can see those things that are coming, and that's why I have my long list of concerns and things that mapping. And then international students were at boarding school at Middlesex, were deep into that space as well. The normal things are happening, and then there's these other layers of things that I think people are subtly starting to understand and build upon. But so many of these families are first-time customers, so they don't know what's coming.
The fundamentals are the same. I think what Matt just shared are all true elements of the story. There's the macro and the micro. And I think, the macro is holistic admission in a selective environment continues. The micro, testing and financial aid and internationalism and AI, those are real. Like none of that is an imagined set of questions.
Yeah, and I've got each of those points on my list of questions for you both. Before we dive in, one last question. Matt mentions first-time customers. So for those who are listening, and this is your first go-round as a student applying to college, and parents, your applications were many years in the past. Let's just define, Lee and Matt, the holistic admissions process you mentioned. And it indeed is a process that is largely the same as it has been for many decades. And in that regard, it doesn't change this fall. But holistic is the whole person, taking the measure of the whole person. But how would you, Lee, and you, Matt, for a first-time customer, define the holistic admissions process?
Holistic admissions has been the standard we use for over 100 years, with various policies coming and going through that holistic review. But holistic means you are the sum of many parts. My predecessors would say it represents your full range of talents. You are an academic, you are someone who does things outside of a classroom, you have a voice that animates a classroom, a residence hall, a campus, you have passions, you have qualities that aren't measurable but still count. And you fit into this campus landscape that we are constructing. And as we build the landscape on our campus, we're also meeting you where you are. So, how do we include the environment that produced you as part of your story? So it's storytelling, it's data analysis, it's knitting together all these different pieces into the whole that is you.
Matt, anything you would add?
Well, I would add, I was raised in a holistic admissions process at Harvard, where you had area people who went and visited the schools, knew the kids and the counselors, and understood their territories, represented the students, and brought a full story to the committee table, and the committee voted. And that process is still very true at Harvard, but every school has a culture of decision making. And how, and for part of me as a college counselor, I try to study and understand how does an admissions office make decisions. And I know at the highly selective schools, the holistic read is there. There is a whole different world going on out there with big data, and that process is evolving in ways that's really hard for families to understand. My charge with my students is, how do you tell your complete story on every inch of your common application? How do you make sure you're articulating what's important to you and how that's going to match with an institution authentically? That's exciting, that's fun. It helps kids really understand why they want to go to a place like Dartmouth. Or go down to a school like Middlebury just down the road. So there's a lot of opportunity to build a holistic process on my side of the desk as well.
So I talked about the 30,000 foot analogy as if you were flying in a plane. Some of these headlines to carry the analogy are the turbulence. And so I want to take a series of these headlines and sort of take them apart again from the perspective of a student or a parent or a counselor or an admissions officer. So Matt, you mentioned testing. Let's start with testing. Before we talk about ACT, SAT, let's just talk about standardized testing requirements and where things stand this fall.
I mean, there has been a shift towards highly selective colleges, many of them in the Ivy League and whatnot, who've moved back to requiring testing or expecting testing as part of their process. But there are a lot of different terms out there in terms of what people want in terms of testing if they're test optional. And I think that's where there's a lot of confusion going on for families in terms of understanding Do I represent my testing? How does my testing help my process? How does it articulate my strengths as a student? And I think that's where we spend a lot of time trying to help our students align their testing profiles with the schools they're applying to. And there are a number of schools that are test-free and are very committed to that.
Lee, Dartmouth was in the vanguard of schools that reinstated standardized testing following the pandemic when most schools suspended those tests, in part because, at least early on, it was hard to take the tests. For somebody listening who's applying to a school that is either test required or test optional, how do you know if you have what's constituted as a good score? How does Dartmouth determine whether something is a good score?
Yeah. So to the lesson of the pandemic as it relates to testing was connecting the testing to the local context, not just the campus context. So historically, you would say we have an average SAT of X and the range is Q to Z. And students would sit down with their counselor and say, is my score near that average? Is it in that range? And that was the interpretation of competitive. And I'm hoping the pandemic taught us that we can be more elastic in the way we meet data and understand it. So, for example, a student should go to the guidance or the counseling office and say, what are the average score profile from my high school? And then, how does your score relate to that local factor? And this is especially true in a public high school where the class is more heterogeneous than perhaps at a school like Matt's, where there's been an admission process that actually sets that cohort. But if you find that your score is above the high school average or above the 75th percentile, that's a really good score. That's a competitive score from your high school. And whether it's an optional process or a required process, those test scores add to the data narrative in your file. If you don't include testing, you're leaving the data narrative open to whatever your grade point average is. So I think my advice for everybody is as you move through the fall, having a set of scores is helpful. Take them one more time if you can this fall. If your scores seem in the zone or above the zone locally, those are worth sharing. And as admission officers, we are reading your scores through that local lens. I'll give you an example from Dartmouth as the class enrolled this fall, we did not share an average score for the class of 29 as they arrived. We said 90% of that class had a test score in the top quarter of their high school. I hope that's a more helpful way of thinking about testing as we go forward.
So, Matt, as we think about the ACT and the SAT, any particular changes in those tests that are worth flagging for students and families?
Well, I think the SAT is pretty an is moving well along the line. It is a digital test, and I think more and more of our students are leaning towards the SAT and preferring the digital test. The ACT is now shifting to a new enhanced ACT this fall. It's going to have fewer questions. It's going to be a better paced test in a lot of ways. But there's a lot of questions about the scoring of the new ACT. And how that's going to play out. And then the other factor is that the science reasoning section is going to be optional for the students to take and then also to report to the colleges. And that optional aspect of the science reasoning will also impact the super score that the students have. That creates a lot of confusion because many colleges don't have real clear policies on their websites about what they want and don't want and how they're going to super score the old and new ACTs.
And we
And
just, for as purposes of definition for somebody who's new, let's define superscore.
Superscore. So with the ACT, the old superscore would be your best. There are four subsections, and you take your best four subsections from the different test dates, and you combine that to get your superscore. So maybe you took it in April and June, and you combine your best English, reading, math, and science reasoning to get your best score. Now you can take the science reasoning out and just do English, reading and math to get your best super score. And then the new test has a different, it's a different test. The hard thing for the students is that on the common application, the way it's reported, it's your best English, reading, math, and composite score. And the students want to report their best super score.
And what's interesting as I'm listening to Matt describe that is, I know that's what happens in schools. There's a lot of fussing about a lot of details. And the word optional is probably the most wicked word in college admissions. Because while the colleges think, oh, we're giving you the choice to include something or not, where that ball bounces, whether it's an optional SAT, ACT, an optional subscore on the ACT, an optional essay, an optional interview. People say to me, optional means required. And I was like, no, if it were required, we would say required. Those aren't synonyms, but people don't believe us. There's this worry that optional is a must. It's not. And I would say the news you could use piece of this is on the college side, we don't spend as any time second guessing your decision to include or not include something. Like if there's an optional essay and you don't share it, it doesn't look bad. If there's an optional subscore in the ACT in science and you're majoring in English, I wouldn't give it a second thought. And honestly, as we move into this cycle with this piece of news as a new thing, I don't think a lot of us are going to spend very much time at all as we read, pondering, was the science score in your ACT composite, and does it change your super score? Probably won't.
All right, so moving on to another subject. Matt, you mentioned AI, artificial intelligence. Let's talk about it from a student's perspective and admissions officer's perspective. Matt, start with the students. Our world is changing so rapidly as AI inserts itself into tasks and activities that were unimaginable as recently as a year ago or even more recently than that. To what extent are your students sort of wrestling with AI as a tool vis-a-vis their college applications, and what sort of counsel do you give them?
We had our Common App boot camp, and we met with the seniors, and we talked about how the colleges want to hear their authentic selves. They want to hear that verb, the teenage language, the spin that only teenagers can put into a college essay. And Tufts just came out with a great piece about you can use AI maybe as a thinking partner or a brainstorming tool, but not as the author of your essays. And I think that's the critical part. And I think, from my years of reading essays, and I'm sure Lee would as well, when you read a kid's essay, you can tell within the context of their grades, their school, their testing, is this essay actually aligned with what I see in the file? And it's almost like you're a detective. You're understanding, you're putting together this kid's narrative. And if the essay doesn't align, the mom wrote the essay, they had an essay consultant, it doesn't align, it just doesn't feel right. And I think with AI, the way it writes, it just writes in a way that just doesn't sound like a teenager. But we want them to have that zip that a teenager has. And I think it's so important that it's also within the context of what the rest of the folder says.
I love that sentence, Matt, the zip that a teenager has, and AI doesn't have it.
It makes a huge difference. It could be a funny phrase, it could just be a bad punctuation moment, but there's an element of like there's this these moments these kids have, and sometimes you have to pull it out of them because they don't feel like their story is unique or special, but it is. And when you get to that point with the kid, it's so wonderful.
Yeah, I come to it from the perspective of a writer, and it's all about voice. I've sat with Lee and colleagues as they've read so many essays, and they have an unbelievable ear for voice, and I think they can tell when that voice is not authentic or when that voice is filtered.
I would say from my years of reading admissions files at Harvard, I have one essay that I saved from a girl from Saginaw High School who typewrote the essay about growing up in Saginaw. Her dad worked at the GM plant and read her poetry. And he never went to college. It was a very blue-collar, non-college background, and she wrote one of the most beautiful essays on typed paper. She had one of the few 800 verbals in the state of Michigan that year. And she was lucky to go to Harvard, and she's now a reporter in Michigan. So, like, there aren't that many essays. I always tell students, your essay is very few essays get you into college. a poorly written essay can get you out.
All right, so I've got an actual headline to bounce off you both. This is from the Wall Street Journal, August 29th, by Jeffrey Salingo, a renowned education writer, author. The headline is "The Elite College Myth." Here's the subheadline: "Panicky parents often think their children's success in life depends on going to a prestigious school. In reality, there are many paths to achieving great things." And I'll just read one quote from the piece. "Attending an Ivy League university does open doors, but it's not the guarantee of extraordinary success that parents seem to think. Nor does attending a different school preclude you from achieving great things." So, Lee, let's start with you. Among other tasks and activities that families are engaged in right now is refining their lists, making sure that their college lists are balanced with aspirational schools, sort of target schools, schools that might seem a little more comfortable. And they're wrestling with this notion of schools like Dartmouth that are quite hard to get into in terms of selectivity, and other schools that may not have the same selectivity but may not have the same profile nationally. What do you think of Salingo's basic premise? An Ivy League university does open doors, but is not the guarantee of extraordinary success that parents seem to think.
That's a tricky question for the dean of admission at one of the Ivies to answer, Jack. I'm going to agree. It's, yeah. I mean, we are, there's eight places in the country that fall into that league. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of places around the United States and Canada and the UK and Australia that offer really wonderful undergraduate programs. And I think one of the conundrums of my work is the frenzy that swirls around a tiny subset of those options. And hearing people say, if we don't get one, we will have failed. And again, pronoun we. I know lots of people, myself included, who did undergraduate work outside the Ivy League and have lived really lovely, productive, successful lives. Having said that, the places are special and deserve to have the spotlight we have as opportunities. Doesn't mean they're the only opportunities. And I think it's keeping that perspective. And the one thing I would add to Salingo's assessment is for people like me, who needed financial aid to go to college, these campuses have really remarkable resources that they share to expand access to higher ed to students from families that don't have the means to do it. And so the upside of, I'll say, the campus where I work is, we enrolled a class of 1,200 students and offered them almost $42 million in scholarships. It's a remarkable amount of money for such a tiny class. And so that's also true, is that Matt mentioned financial aid and budgets as one of his worries. At a point in higher ed, that's not a worry. I don't work at a campus that's, are we paying attention to financial aid? Of course. Are we changing our aid policies because the economy is wobbly or our endowment is not taxed? No. Are there some places that must? Perhaps. So I think it's being an informed person around what are the policies and resources campus to campus. And as you move into the spotlight part of the list, aid is usually not a question mark. Getting in is a question mark. Getting the scholarship you need once admitted is not a question mark. Matt, does that sound right?
I would say the ability to fund students at levels that are extraordinary, because most of the Ivy League schools are even beyond federal methodology. They are able to really make it, I mean, even better than when I was a student, life-changing opportunities financial aid-wise. Part of my work is building these balanced lists, helping students stretch and go for their dreams with eyes wide open about the opportunity costs. I wanted to offer another perspective. I'm from St. Louis, and in St. Louis, the question they always ask you is where you went to high school. That's how they define you. They want to know where you went to high school. They can tell a lot about you in that. And I always say to my students in Boston, they ask you where you went to graduate school. And so you're going to be a lifelong learner. Where you go for your master's or whatever your professional degree or your PhD may have a more definitive stamp on your life than just going to college. And so I think there's the other opportunity to think about it. It's beyond just a 4-year experience.
And it's Jack, I think the trick of this is being pragmatic and marrying your romance with reality. So as the list comes into focus over the fall, it's not top heavy. You know, to the Salinga article, in some zip codes and in some high schools, there's a really tiny list of options that make sense. Years ago, when I was at Tufts, we had a student transferring out after her first year, and we always did an exit interview. And the dean said to her, "Why are you leaving? What was wrong?" And she said, "I love it here." And the dean said, "I'm confused. Why are you transferring?" And the student said, "At my high school, success means one of the eight Ivies, and I came close but didn't get it. And so, to be legitimate, I have to go to an Ivy." And that's a sad way of thinking, because she loved where she was, but some standard overrode that. And these are individual choices. You go where you can because it's your choice. But I think it fuels this worry in many places and among many people that the odds are long at this tiny group, and that's where the stress comes from. Versus, you know, I have lots of examples of students who realistically set their list around their credentials, and they got in everywhere. That's a lovely outcome that allows choice to happen throughout, because it wasn't a top-heavy list. It was a list where the college counselor said, "This feels like a realistic shot, if you tell your story well."
So, Matt, you talked about financial aid. Let's come back to that subject. The free application for federal student aid goes live on October 1st. It has been in the headlines. Imagine a family that is going to need to apply for financial aid, a student who's going to need to apply for financial aid. Just a few quick pieces of advice and counsel as they head into that particular process in this particular fall.
So one of our big goals with our families who are first-time applicants for financial aid is to create their federal student aid ID number. And so you need to go in, and the parents and the students need to create their own FSA IDs. And that's an important step before you get into the FAFSA. And that's where, in some cases, if you have any issues around citizenship status or you know, wherever you are in that process, you can catch those issues and solve those problems before you get into the application. So the FSA ID is hugely important as a first step. And then when you get to the FAFSA, it's actually, and from someone who's actually filling one out himself for a child, it actually works fairly well, because it pulls in the IRS data. A lot of the information kind of naturally gravitates in. And I've found the new FAFSA, once they got the kinks worked out, to work really well. And it's actually, it does not take a lot of time. The CSS profile, on the other hand, takes a lot more time to fill out. For us, it's getting our families aligned with the first step, and then everything else works really well.
That's the good news, though, Jack. The last couple of years, there were snafus in the rollout of the new FAFSA, and that seems to be behind us. And so the promise of the reforms is now here.
So I've got two more topics, then I'm going to ask you both if there's any topic I've forgotten, and then I'm going to toss back to Lee to close out. The first one is the role of race and ethnicity in this year's college application process. For listeners who are new to all this, several years ago, the Supreme Court said that admissions offices could not consider race as a factor in a student's consideration for admission, in terms of sort of checking a box and having the very checking of that box sort of elevate your application in the process. But at the same time, Chief Justice John Roberts said in the same decision that students could talk about their identity and their lived experience in their essays, including if they wanted to talk about their racial identity and how that had informed their lives and experiences. It's the fall of 25. Lee, particularly for listeners who are students of color, any tweaks they should make in their approach as they apply to colleges that use the holistic admissions process.
So, Jack, I'm going to broaden your question and say for all students from all types of identities and backgrounds, the opportunity is the same. Tell your story in your own words and introduce yourself in whatever way that matters to you. And give us the narrative that helps us imagine you and your perspective on this campus, in the classroom. If it is in fact your racial identity that you want to highlight and celebrate, do it in a way that doesn't just say, I am a Mexican American student, period, but I'm a Mexican American living in suburban Pennsylvania and blah, blah, blah. Like, broaden it to say, like, how your identity has informed your person, your experience. That's valid as part of our holistic review. What we can't do, there was a story last year in the New York Times where the student said something like, yeah, I just need to make sure they know I'm a black guy from the Bronx. That ought to do it. We can't use that. Like, that's not life experience. That's just identity. And the ruling requires colleges to focus on the experiential piece, not the identity in and of itself. And that's the big shift. I think we were always doing life experience, even before the Supreme Court cases against Harvard and Chapel Hill. But after the court ruled, the guidelines changed. The emphasis on race neutral, the emphasis on celebrating all types of background. Anyway, so, but Matt, I'm curious, as you work with students, how well do they understand what I just said?
I think there's a general understanding that there's been a change in how the colleges are discussing, talking about, and evaluating students who are BIPOC. I think students have to have a level of comfort talking about their, particularly their racial identity in their application. And some students feel that can be performative and can be not true to themselves. But there are a lot of students from lots of different backgrounds, first gen, transgendered, gay, who may feel vulnerable in the process. And even I think there's worry that the Supreme Court or maybe the Justice Department is interested in essays now as we move forward in terms of how colleges are using them in their evaluation process. But I think our goal is to have students really tell their full story without them feeling like they're compromising their integrity. And I think most students are willing to tell their story in a really powerful way.
So, you know, in the last 6 to 9 months, there have been lots of topics that have started to shift and open, and Matt outlines a bunch of them. There have been a couple of executive orders that land squarely in the space where I work. And our counselors have said to me, when there's an executive order, we need to start to pay attention. But many of them don't take effect immediately. They signal direction more than an immediate change of course. And sometimes they're overturned. So I think if you're an applicant moving through, you know, these next weeks towards the application deadlines, my advice is do what you're going to do. Don't let the story from outside of the college admission process alter the way you introduce yourself. And remember, anything that's happening in Washington, D.C., or wherever is not changing the way you, as an applicant, use the application. It may change the way the college constructs its application in the future, or the way we evaluate that application. But as an applicant, you're not the direct actor in the change. So the Common App is live. It is set for the class of 2026. Fill it out.
So last headline, international students. And some of our listeners, Matt, are students from locations outside the US. We've also got students in the US who are looking forward to going to school with students from international backgrounds. A lot of activity from DC on this subject, new hoops that international students need to go through. Can we generalize about the state of international student attendance to American universities this fall?
I know that my international students, for the first time and since I've been at Middlesex, have been adding more international schools to their college list. Schools in the UK, in Asia, Australia. Not many, but they're adding a diversity of schools to their list to have more opportunities in Canada, for example, as well. So I think there's some intentionality by international students to make sure they have a better portfolio of options as they move forward. I think the international students are still a priority for many colleges because they bring incredible talent, revenue, and opportunity for many colleges and universities have relationships with cities, countries, institutions that they want to maintain and develop and grow. So there's a lot of historical aspects to these relationships with international students. So I think it's important just to make sure that if you're applying widely, that you have a broader range of schools on your list that are not in the United States. I think for students who are international students who need financial aid, I think it's going to be a even more competitive marketplace than it's ever been in terms of students who need financial aid. I think the full pay students will still have more opportunities. And I think that's institution by institution. I mean, Lee's in a position where he can fund the international students he wants to, but not every dean of admissions has that luxury. So, we have some Ukrainian students at Middlesex who are amazing, and there are students who need a lot of support. And so far, we've been blessed that they've all landed well. But it's something that keeps me up at night, when I'm working with students who are international who need financial aid.
Yeah, and Jack, next week's episode will dive deeply into this topic of international admissions in the fall of 2025 because it is a shifting landscape with a lot of questions. It's interesting, when I get asked by our local papers or in our international enrollment, it was steady. All of the students we admitted got their visas and they're here. So that's a reassurance. I wasn't sure a few months ago that that would happen. It did. So I think there's a proof point of, we could worry or we can continue to look forward and react when it's time to react. But don't, I think the danger of the noise that chirps all around us is people preemptively react. And sometimes you miss out on an opportunity because you ducked and you didn't need to.
So, last question for you both, sort of a lightning round as we bring this to a close. Matt, starting with you, is there a headline that you had wanted to talk about that I missed that you think would be important for the students and families and counselors and admissions folks in our audience?
Well, one of the things I've been watching carefully are the budgets on college campuses. And so I have concerns about what's going to happen this spring around regular decision and some colleges, not all, with their ability to fund students. So I think for families, watching and reading about the institutions and what's going on with their budgets is something that's important. And it is important to make sure that you have a good, if you're in the regular decision marketplace, make sure you have a good range of schools where you're high in profile and you're highly desired because you might get better funding.
Part of the process from a parent perspective is to be an educated consumer, to let your applicant explore, imagine, fall in love when that happens, while you study the policies that may be shifting and then nudge the romantic a step towards the pragmatic as you need to. But as you imagine, changes in the fiscal health of a campus, yes, it then manifests itself in questions around program affordability that a family will need to think about as a list is constructed. And those are the parts of college admission that aren't as fun and warm and fuzzy, but they're important. Like, there's a lot of moving parts here, but I end, Jack, with where I began. We deliberately poked through some of the topics that were on Matt's worry list because they're valid. And these are the things people in schools are thinking about. And if you're not in a school with a person like Matt who's thinking about it, you've heard him think about it. So, raise the question in your school and see what the answer is. But any last thoughts from you, Jack? I mean, Jack, I mean, I have a question for you before we wrap. So, you're chatting with Dan Rather, you're chatting with Matt and me. You're a student of higher ed through the media prism. What's your take on what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, I'm aligned with you both. I am a realist. These developments are serious and they're important, and they are going to have, potential impact on the college choices and experiences of at least some of the folks who are listening to us today. I've been quite literally following around in a journalistic capacity, people, you both and other colleagues, since the beginning of the 2000s, and that holistic admissions process has largely held, and the people who engage in that process, Matt on his side of the desk, you on yours, Lee, so many others, are committed to the integrity of this process and its values, and there are folks who could be doing lots of other careers, in lots of other settings with a lot less aggravation. And yet they're committed to this point of access, and I hope, and not in a Pollyanna-ish way, that that provides some hope to our listeners at this, fraught moment in the life of our nation and our world.
Yeah. So, speaking of world, as I mentioned, we'll be back next week with an episode on international admissions. Matt, Jack, thanks for joining me on Admission Beat.
Anytime.
Yeah. For now, this is Lee Coffin from Dartmouth College. Thanks for listening.